Perfect Stranglers contains graphic and explicit content suitable for mature listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Perfect Stranglers. This is Kylie.
And I'm Bree.
And happy 23rd of December. If you celebrate Christmas, happy fucking Christmas, you guys.
Yeah, it's Christmas Eve.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a very important day. Christmas Eve. This is the day that you take a moment and be happy you're not around your family, because the next 2 days, you're going to be surrounded. And you're not going to be able to breathe. And yeah. So this is that day for you to just relax, listen to a great episode of Perfect Stranglers, have a glass of your favorite beverage, and just fucking chill.
Yeah.
Because the next 2 days may or may not be a clusterfuck for you.
And even if you like your family, it still can be a lot.
The traveling, the needing to talk.
Ugh.
You know?
Yeah. It's like you almost want to, like, have a seminar on how your life is going, so with, like, a whole group of aunts and uncles, so that you don't have to explain it, like, 12 times.
Yes, that is exactly
like,
right.
I'm going to just prepare a PowerPoint, you know?
And you don't have, yes. Did you see that PowerPoints are, like, a thing? People are presenting PowerPoints to their boomer parents and uncles and aunts and all that stuff to show things that are, like, no, this is why you're wrong and these are my facts.
Yes. I saw a girl who presented a PowerPoint to her parents, just telling them that she was a stripper and how much she made and
yes.
what it was like, and that she supported herself, like she has makes tons of money from it. And in the end, like in the beginning, they were like arms crossed, like what the heck, but at least mm-hmm. they were listening. And yep. at the end, they were like, all right, yeah.
I just know that if I were to do that, it would not go over well, because I would use words that half of my family doesn't understand.
Ooh.
Like, I just know that it wasn't. And I would do the PowerPoint, honestly. I would do the PowerPoint on Michigan weather. I could do it on. And it would be just. Yeah. I feel like I could. What else would I like to do a PowerPoint on? Imagine doing a. I think you posted something about, like, the meaning of Thanksgiving, like, why Thanksgiving is bullshit on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. I have a huge attitude about that, and I posted all day.
Yeah. I love it. I loved every minute of it. You know what? I would do a freaking PowerPoint on why everything on the internet isn't always true, and on how to use Facebook.
Yeah. So, basically, how to research and what your
yes.
what your librarians should have taught you, or you should have listened to them.
Yes.
Like, didn't you guys have to do, like, a National History Day and learn how to research and stuff like that? Like,
exactly, yes. I would love to do a PowerPoint on how to research to my family and be like, no, this is what you're seeing, but this is not exactly what, like, is true.
Yeah.
This is an opinion being peddled as a fact.
Right. Is it from a credible source? What is that source?
Exactly.
Like,
yes, and what is a credible, what does a credible source look like?
Right.
And science is your friend. The end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that would be so fun. I would love every minute of it. And I would love to do a PowerPoint on why turkey is awful. Just to, like, because people, you know what? We passed Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But you know what? Some people get another fucking turkey for Christmas.
Yeah, they do. Why do they do that?
I don't know. Why are you doubling up on turkey?
No. It's turkey for Thanksgiving, like, beef for Christmas, or goose if you're from England. And
some people do ham.
Ham is for Easter.
Yeah, ham is for Easter. I've never heard beef. You know what Anthony's family used to do? This is disgusting, and I could not even stand it. So Anthony and I worked at Papa Murphy's. Their tradition was on Christmas Eve was to get a Papa Murphy's pizza, and then they would make clam chowder. So what did their house smell like?
Ugh.
Their house was like... They are hoarders. There are a lot of animals and a lot of stuff. So you can imagine what that would probably smell like. But then there's Papa Murphy's and the smell of clams in this house that was full of stuff and animals, if you know what I mean.
I hate it.
Yeah. It was When I was pregnant and had morning sickness,
oh
I had
my
to walk
God.
into that house. Anthony looked at me and my eyes started watering. He's like, are you okay? And I was like, I don't think I can do it.
No.
And it took me about 5 minutes to like try and walk into the house because all I could smell was clams and Papa Murphy's. And the smell of like the house.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh
it my was, God. It was, it was real like, God, I hate seafood. I fucking hate
I do
seafood.
Too.
The smell of it. I know. I think I'm the only one of us three stranglers who like remotely enjoys seafood in that I love, I like shrimp and I like a good old fashioned like fish fry that is so battered and doesn't even taste like fish anymore.
Yeah, I can't even do that.
No. Oof. No.
Yucky.
That's yeah. That's
but
good.
You know,
and also why is ham?
Also, I imagine if you have worked at Papa Murphy's for a long time, the smell of Papa Murphy's probably isn't that great to you either.
No, I can all of the pizzas smell and taste the same to me, and I can immediately like recognize the smell of it when someone's making it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even though they don't cook in there, it still all tastes, it all smells the same.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I was going to say, why is ham pink? And why doesn't it have
Pigs
a normal
pink.
Meat texture? But I know, but it doesn't even have a normal meat texture, you know what I mean?
I guess. Like, it's not really stringy or like,
yeah, it
like
doesn't
a
have
beef
like,
roast or something.
Yeah, like chicken and it doesn't have a chicken texture. Chicken, fish, even steak all have grain to it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe that's why I don't like it. I don't really
and
eat
it
ham.
Doesn't ham doesn't have the typical meat texture. So like what is it?
Yeah.
Is the ham a piece that you cut off of a pig or is it pieces of the pig processed together into a ham?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe some hams. I don't know. Like
See?
The on Christmas with the Cranks, the hickory honey ham.
Yeah.
It looks disgusting.
Yeah.
It's a canned ham.
Ew.
That's gross.
Ew. That's fucking disgusting. Have
what
you ever
even
seen
is that?
The whole canned? That's disgusting is what it is. Have you ever seen the whole canned chickens?
Oh my God, yuck. I've seen it on the internet.
Could you imagine?
It's like jellied almost, like looks like
yes.
Like gross. Oh my God.
A jellied chicken in a can.
That's disgusting.
That's worse than Spam.
Yeah, it is.
That is worse
Spam's
than Spam.
Spam's gross too.
One time, Everly, we have like Spam for when the world ends and we need food. You know, everyone has that stockpile. No, they do. And Everly has been begging me to make Spam.
Like fried Spam?
Because she wants to know what it is. Well, she wants to know what's in those containers because she's never seen them before. And I keep on telling her it's like meat, but it's like not. And she just wants to know. So one day I was like, crap, gonna open a can, making it smelling like nasty cat food in here. She takes one bite of it and she's like, I don't like it. And I was like, I told you, you weren't going to like it. I told you. However, there is a place here called Max's Celsius Hideaway. And they make sushi, but they make Spam sushi. And I had it on a date once. And the guy I was with, he had been there a lot. And he's like, just, do you like Spam? And I was like, not really, but I'm like willing to try if it's like made like in a place like this where it might be good, because you never know. It was really fucking good. You could not tell that it was Spam. Yeah. And I know they eat that a lot over in like Hawaii is like a big thing is Spam.
Interesting.
But it wasn't bad. Yeah, it wasn't bad. Anyway, Brie, you want to do housekeeping? I'm wearing my Beats headphones, and they squeeze so hard on my head that I'm starting to get a headache from
them. That's the worst.
You know, they paid so much money for these, because I was like, I want good headphones for the gym and stuff. I don't know if any of you guys have this problem with your Beats headphones, but they, like, push right against my temples and around my ears, and it fucking hurts my jaw.
Oh, yeah.
They hate them. They're just the biggest waste of money I've ever witnessed. Anyway.
That's a shame. Okay, stranglers, don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts because it helps us get seen and it helps people find us. Also, don't forget to subscribe to us on, you know, whatever other platform you listen to because we want to make sure that you never miss an episode. We also want to hear from you on our social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we also want to hear your stories of weird, true things that have happened to you, which we haven't gotten in a while. And I know you guys are hoarding them. So, come on. Give up the stories.
Give them to me.
So you have to email us those stories, por favor, at contact@perfectstranglers.com. And while you're at it, check out our website, which is perfectstranglers.com.
Yeah, you know what you also could do? You also could just DM us.
Yeah, on our Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, I'd be cool with that. Yeah. DM us. Drop us a line, as Bruce says. All right, are we ready to get into this?
Yes.
Let's. Okay. I am doing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
In
2014, there was a plane that just went missing.
Yeah. I do remember that.
I'm doing that.
Okay.
And I am so excited about it. Because it's unlike anything I've done. Mm-hmm. It really is. And a new news article came out about it 2 days ago. And I was like, changed exactly what I was doing. And I was like, we're doing this and we got to do it now.
Okay.
So this is what's going down in Strangler Town today. So Malaysia Airlines Flights 370, also known as MH370 or MAS370. I'm going to call it MH370. By the way, guys, I highly recommend you get a map out because I'm going to be like calling out different locations and it's going to really help to see what I'm talking about. So if you are in a position where you can pull up a map on your phone or whatever, I suggest it because it really freaking helped me figure out what I was talking about.
Okay.
So there's that. So it was a scheduled international passenger flight operated by Malaysia Airlines and it disappeared on March 8th, 2014. It was flying from Kuala Lumpur International Airport to its planned destination of Beijing Capital International Airport in China. So the crew of the Boeing 777 last communicated with Air Traffic Control, ATC, around 38 minutes after its takeoff when the flight was over the South China Sea. So the aircraft was lost from ATC radar screens just a few minutes later after they communicated, and it was deviating westwards from its planned flight path. So flight MH370 had 227 passengers, 12 crew members aboard. All of them are presumed dead, and that's the too long didn't read version. That's the short version. So I'm going to give you the long version, obviously. So we're going to get in the details exactly how an airliner can just disappear seemingly into thin air nowadays. Because, like, if you think of it, that seems impossible for an airplane nowadays to just disappear.
Right. Satellites and stuff.
Turns out it's way fucking easier than you'd think. Like, it's actually common. Not super common, but it's, like, common enough to where it's like, yeah, this happens.
Man. That's scary.
All right. So let's talk about the pilots here. The pilot in command was a 53-year-old captain, pilot. His name was Zahari Ahmed Shah. Sorry, I'm probably going to fuck up names here. I'm not trying to. But they're all from Malaysia and, you know, shit happens. Anyway, 53-year-old Captain Zahari Ahmed Shah from Penang. He joined Malaysia Airlines as a cadet pilot in 1981. After training and receiving his commercial pilot license, he became a second officer with the airline in 1983. He was then promoted to captain of a Boeing 737 airliner in 91, then captain of an Airbus A33 in 1996, then captain of a Boeing 777-200 in 1998. And that is similar to the plane. I think the one that we're going to be talking about is a Boeing 777-400. Or 200, it's one of them. But he's been a pilot for this plane for a very long time. He knows exactly how it works, in and out. So Zahari Shah had a total of 18,365 flying hours of experience. Flying was like his passion. He even had a flight simulator in his basement that he put together himself from Microsoft. And that flight simulator was of a Boeing 777. So if he wasn't in the air, he was pretending he was in the air. And he was the dude you'd want in charge of your plane if anything was going to go
down.
Sounds
like it.
Like, he was experienced as fuck. He was a family man. His crew and employees loved him. He was known for volunteering in community events. He would make food for the community. And if he couldn't be there to make the food for, like, community events, his family would. However, a couple months before MH370 took off, he kind of became quite reclusive and cold. A few months before the flight day, his daughter came out and said he seemed to be quite depressed and almost acting like he was a different person. And he was spending a lot of time in his flight simulator. And later we'll figure out kind of why he was acting that way and get a little more information. But a day before the flight of MH370, his wife and kids moved out of the house because his family was separated. So a little turmoil there, but nothing some of us haven't experienced, so there's that. The first officer, so his co-pilot, was 27-year-old Farik Abdul Hamid. He joined Malaysia Airlines as a cadet pilot in 2007. After becoming a second officer of a Boeing 737, he was promoted to first officer of a Boeing, of a different plane in 2010. He then transitioned to an Airbus A33 in 2012. And then in November of 2013, a year before, like a few months before, November, December, January, February, March, so like 4 or 5 months before this happened, he began training as a first officer of a Boeing 777. So Flight 370 was actually his final training flight, and he was scheduled to be examined on his next flight to become a pilot in command. So Farik had accumulated 2,763 total hours of flying experience at this point. So Farik was younger, very passionate about aviation. He was a really hard worker. Like I said, this was his final training flight. He was also pretty experienced. He was a ladies' man, and he did sneak a few girls into the cockpit of one of the airplanes to show off a few months before his flight, and that was like his only dark spot on the record. He was actually engaged to a woman who was also in the aviation field. I think she was, I don't know if she was a pilot or she was just a crew on another plane, but so he was engaged. I don't know if he was sneaking girls in as he was engaged, but, you know. He was cocky. He was also a kind dude, a community man. He loved to volunteer. He played like a form of soccer with kids in his like community. He ended up making them like team shirts so that they can be a team and play.
Very cute.
So good dude, right? Two good dudes. So let's talk about the passengers real quick. There was passengers, most of them were from Malaysia and then Indonesia. Then we got China, the US, Canada, Russia, France, India, Iran, Netherlands, New Zealand, Taiwan, Ukraine, and Australia. So those are our passengers, where they're from. There were also two men who got on the plane with fake passports and lied to get through security. The passports said that they were Australian and Italian. However, they were actually Iranian. So we'll talk about more on those people later.
Okay. Red flag.
So those are our passengers that they lied about their passports. So then let's talk about the plane. It was made by Boeing. This particular aircraft was the 404th Boeing 777 made. It was 242.4 feet long, just over 770,000 pounds. It's the largest twin jet plane that is made today. Each plane has four Rolls-Royce engines. And if y'all don't know, car places like Ford, Rolls-Royce, fucking Tesla, whatever. They don't just make car engines. They actually make engines for a lot of different machines. And they don't just make car parts. They make parts for different types of like machinery altogether. So a Boeing 77 has a Rolls-Royce engine.
Wow.
Four of them. And the Boeing 777 has 1/5 of the power of a space shuttle engine. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
To me, that people are just floating around on that. So this specific plane, the 404th Boeing 77 made, took its first flight on May 14th of 2002. And as of the day of the flight we're going to talk about in 2014, until that point, it had logged 53,471 hours of flying. time. It's taken 7,526 successful flights around the Malaysian airspace, and just over 70 trips alone to the destination of flight MH370, which was to Beijing International Airport in China. So that seems like a lot, but it's not at all. Like, at all, 53,000 hours is half of its lifetime.
Oh.
So most Boeing 777s last about 25 years, and it had only been in the air for 12. So it was still, like, peak performance condition.
Mm-hmm.
So this plane is very well known for being one of the safest passenger planes that you can travel in. You are more likely to be struck by lightning than to experience any accidents in a 777. That is a fact from the research, and it makes me not want to fly. Thank you. Everything is always compared to how likely you are to be struck by lightning.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel very bad about myself. If you're all are new here, I've been struck by lightning. Thank you. Listen to episode 7 about 40 minutes in and you'll hear it. So this specific plane did have a unique kind of fault, though. I wouldn't call it a fault, but a unique incident happened. On August 9th, 2012, the plane just landed in Shanghai, China, and it was on the tarmac taxiing towards the terminals. When the plane collided with another plane on the taxiway and its right wingtip was broken off, it was about 6 feet of it was broken off, and it was embedded into the Chinese aircraft. Okay. This damage was actually minor, though. Even though it sounds major, it was minor in comparison. It was just a wing. It wasn't like an engine or anything.
Yeah.
So Boeing took it in. 2 months later, it was fixed just like new. They didn't just replace the tip. They replaced the entire right wing.
Okay.
So after it was inspected, it was completely like it passed all safety compliance standards like new, good to go. We're ready to fly. Okay. So this brings us to the flight in question, MH370. So this night was a night of perfect flight. It was beautiful out. Like, Derek, what are you looking at?
There was a lady in a motorized scooter playing music very, very loudly outside.
Oh, fucking lacrosse, man. Okay, when I went back to home, it was a goddamn, not a culture shock, because I know the culture, but it was definitely like, this is small town.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is small town. This is true Wisconsin. Like, rural Wisconsin is unlike any other rural area I've been in. I've been in rural Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, all enough to be like, I know what this is like. Like, I've been there, done that. Rural Wisconsin is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
It is homey, but also incredibly clicky when it comes. I don't know how to describe
yeah.
it. It is homey, like, but you feel the country coming off of everything.
Yeah.
It is unreal. It is unreal. Like, I cross the border into Beloit and you can just feel the country. Even when you're in the city, you can feel the country of everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild to me. I didn't realize that until this time. Even when I spend some time in Indiana and Illinois and here in Michigan, I just don't get that vibe.
Yeah.
It's not rural. It's rural, but it doesn't, the personality isn't there. Wisconsin has a personality. How about that? Yeah. Anyway, sidebar. So the night was a night like every other night. There was no hiccups with takeoff. Everyone on board had no issues getting on the plane. There were no security threats were detected during onboarding with the passengers. We'll learn about the passports later on. The crew were able to get the cabin prepped properly. The night was a beautiful night for flight. As Derek Shepherd would say, it's a beautiful day to save lives, people. Turbulence was low. The sky was clear. Perfectly normal. Average. Just average. Okay. So, on top of that, the flight path that they were taken has been taken many, 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 many times before. Many times before. So it was routine. So flight MH370 took off at 12:41 a.m. local time, reached a cruising altitude of 35,000 feet at 1:01 a.m. from Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia to the planned destination, Beijing Capital International Airport in China. The direct flight was 5 hours and 34 minutes. Less than an hour into the flight, this is what happened according to physical facts we have collected by the Malaysian government. All right, so around 10 p.m., the passengers were on their way through security in the airport with no issues. The flight had an expected arrival time in Beijing of 5:30 a.m., so this was like a dead-of-the-night red-eye flight, okay? At 11 p.m., 12 crew members and the two pilots we talked about boarded the plane, prepped the plane for takeoff. Everything was great. At 11:40 p.m., all of the passengers began boarding the plane, getting settled. At 12:30 a.m., all of the passengers and crew were settled in without a hitch. Hamid, the younger of the pilots, because he was like, even though Shah was like the captain, Hamid was the one in charge of this flight because it was his last training flight. Okay, so it's like he was cutting the hair and the instructors are watching him cut the hair. Okay. So Hamid requested permission to take off from air traffic controller, which you have to do. ATC granted him permission and they were off. So at 12:40 a.m. on March 8th, 2014, flight MH-70 was in the air on takeoff. The flight was heading north towards Beijing and in normal, consistent communication with ATC. 10 minutes later, at 12:50 a.m., MH370 was instructed to take their first handoff to Lumpur ATC. So that was in Malaysia from the airport tower. So they transfer communication from the airport tower to actual air traffic control.
Okay.
So that was the first handoff. Within seconds, the transfer was complete and the plane flew to 35,000 feet standard altitude for commercial aircraft. This radioed handoff happened in seconds, which is the norm. At most, during bad weather, this type of handoff, whether from an air tower to ATC or ATC to a different air traffic controller, usually takes a few seconds. Any gap longer than that is called a black spot when flying. Reasons for this could be like they're going through there's a bad radio connection, bad weather, that type of thing. The reason why this is so important is air traffic control is their eyes. It's how they know where they're going. Like the plane has a radar, you know, but they have no idea where they're going. Air traffic control is telling them where they need to steer. Without air traffic control, they're flying completely blind in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Well, it's not like there's landmarks.
Right. Like they're flying blind. Like they can't just look down at their, like in movies, you see they look down at their plane and they know where they're going. That's not how it works.
No, if you're that high up, you're not going to, especially if you're above the clouds.
Right. And you have no idea if another aircraft is going to be coming towards you. So when you're going from country to country, it's basically ATC is like air border control. So you also need to hand off your ATC from, like, we would hand off Canadian ATC to United States ATC, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's also a handoff that needs to happen. So at the border of Malaysia and Vietnam, there was the first country-to-country handoff that was to take place. So this is standard, again, common procedure. There would be a few of these transfers actually expected to happen because they're going to be crossing multiple country borders. Yeah. So how this happens is the ATC of the country the plane is currently in wishes the new country good night, and the new country responds with good morning. So like ATC Malaysia good night, and Vietnam would be like ATC Malaysia good morning.
Good with like morning, their coordinates and stuff. Vietnam.
Yep. That's exactly it. Well, that's what happens. So that was the first handoff that they were supposed to take, and that's how they know who has control of the plane. So at 1:19 a.m., MH370 was instructed to hand off to Vietnamese ATC. Hamid agreed to make the handoff, but it never actually happened.
Oh.
So air traffic control, the Malaysian one said, Malaysian, good night, ATC, good night. Vietnam said, good morning. So the verbal handoff happened. The actual radar handoff of handing the plane physically over from Malaysia to Vietnam so that they knew where they were going, that never happened.
So the air traffic control in Vietnam could hear them but not see them on radar?
Okay. Yes.
Got it.
So we have verbal confirmation that Hadid did hand off, like that handoff happened from one tower, one country to the other. Physically, though, that radar blip never popped up. So they were flying blind at this point. The plane remained in that black spot. Because something, like I said, sometimes there's a black spot where if it's a bad radio or a bad radio frequency, whatever, that can happen. Does not happen often. But yeah, they never showed up. ATC tried to make contact with Vietnam MTC, or ATC tried to make contact with MH370, but MH370 was no longer even on their radio frequency. Like, they couldn't even talk to them at this point. And each country has a different radio frequency that they exchange off from. So they were not only flying blind, but they couldn't hear anything at all. Like, gone.
Oh, man.
For all intents and purposes, this plane disappeared at 1:19 a.m.
Yeah.
From everything. Right. So we then found out that's not the only way to know where a plane is if it's in a black spot for ATC. The second way is through a transponder. It's about the size of a deck of cards inside every modern aircraft, and it emits a frequency that can be tracked by radar, and ATC uses it to identify planes, distances, and speed of any incoming aircraft. And this is a universally mandatory plane thing that all planes have, and it is absolutely mandatory, universally mandatory for pilots to keep transponders on at all times.
Is that the black box, or is that something different?
The black box is like audio.
Oh, it's audio recording. Okay.
Yep. Yep. So the only way a pilot is okayed to even tamper with a transponder is in case of an absolute emergency situation. And before the pilot touches it, they must communicate with ATC to ask for permission to touch the transponder.
Okay.
So when MH370 was in the black spot from the regular radio frequency radar of ATC, the transponder was still able to be detected on the plane. And what they saw was that the plane veered off about 30 degrees to the right off course into the South China Sea instead of for land into Vietnam. Mm. This is where your maps are going to come in handy. So this new path happened for 2 minutes, then the transponder was offline and ATC had lost its two sources of radar to track the plane at 1:21 a.m. So this is incredibly odd. This does not happen, especially over the course of only 2 minutes. Like, this is, like, what the fuck, what's happening type of thing. The third way to track an aircraft is, if those two sources of tracking fail, it's the Aircraft Communication Addressing and Reporting System, called ACARS. This transmits data about the aircraft's performance right to Boeing. There are two of these in a Boeing 777. One is in the cockpit right above the pilot's heads. The other is actually in the main cabin in the middle of the plane. Both report different things to Boeing. The one up front reports fuel info, engine info, speed, things like that, how the plane's working. The one in the cabin is there mainly to report cabin pressure.
Okay.
So at 1:21 a.m., both boxes, ACARS boxes, reported the plane flying normally. No engine failure, nothing weird. So this was the time when the transponders lost track of the plane. So we went from ATC to transponder for a couple minutes, and now we're on ACARS units. We were on ACARS units for 1 minute. At 1:22 a.m., both of those boxes went offline.
What? What the heck?
So at this point, we have a plane flying blind in the middle of the night, 30 degrees northwest off course, into the South China Sea.
Mm.
And that's what we got. So the final form of radar is like old school satellite communication.
Yeah.
So the satellite's floating around in space, detect satellite antenna that is on every airplane. So how this works is, like, there are small pings the satellite will look for a specific frequency. And when the satellite finds that specific frequency, it receives a small ping from the antenna, and that's called a handshake. It's basically the satellite and the antenna, like, bumping into each other, saying, oh, nice to see ya, and then they continue on their way. There's no location. It's just a ping. So, using the time between the handshakes, airline engineers are able to calculate how fast an aircraft is moving due to the distance between the antenna and the satellite. So the longer it takes for the satellite to receive a handshake, the further away from the satellite or antenna it is. So we can't do location, but we can do distance. So if we know the last known location, we can then do a radius circle of distance.
Okay.
That makes sense. So this tracking device stayed online for an additional 7 hours after the sources of radar went down that caused the black spot. So from 2:25 a.m. to about 8:19 a.m., 8 handshakes were exchanged, and they calculated that this plane maintained a normal speed of about 600 miles per hour. At 9:15 a.m., there were no longer any handshakes, so the plane went down somewhere between 8:19 and 9:15 a.m. So during all of this, since it was a red eye, friends and family were sleeping during all of this, and they were getting up early to go pick up their loved ones from the airport in Beijing because the plane was supposed to land at 6:30 a.m. But the friends and family kept on being told that the plane was delayed, which is like no big deal. Planes get delayed. But at a certain point, they're like, okay, what's going on? There were also passengers trying to board this plane. And red eye flights are really important because they're often used to like make up delays throughout the day. So for a red eye flight to be delayed is very odd. On top of all of this, that's just like another oddity. So during the time when the plane went missing from ATC, Vietnam and Malaysian ATC personnel realized that there was something very off happening. However, they just kept on tossing the blame back and forth in confusion between Malaysia, Vietnam, and China, because, China, the Beijing air traffic controller, never got the plane. And they're like, you guys, what's going on? And Malaysia's like, well, we handed it off. And Vietnam's like, well, we never received the radar. So they didn't actually report anything missing for hours.
Wow.
Like, I think it was like 4 hours. They didn't report anything missing.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So had they had said something earlier, the plane probably could have been found by, you know, some type of radar or like military looking for a fucking plane flying around. Something could have been done. You know what I mean? So because of this, Beijing, like I said, just kept saying that the plane was delayed. Finally, at 8 a.m., an hour and a half after the expected arrival time, the Malaysian government made a public statement saying that communication was lost and the plane was officially listed as missing. So keep in mind, as they announced this plane was missing, they were actually still in the air. So they announced it. They announced it was missing at 8 a.m., but the last ping happened at 8:19 a.m.
Oh.
Right. And I'm pretty sure, and this is, I went about this, like, the sources I looked at were all in, like, the same time frame. So I'm pretty sure this wasn't, like, a time zone difference. Yeah. I think it was still flying when they announced it. And if it wasn't, it was only, like, an hour behind.
Well, I wonder,
you know what I mean?
The internet worked in the plane.
So some people had their phones and some people didn't. And there were some reports of like people still calling cell phones and those cell phones still working. Yeah. I think there was like
imagine being on the flight and seeing a breaking news that your plane that you are on right now is missing.
Yeah. Not a single one of the friends and family received a text.
Oh my God.
I guess. Like, there was no reports that I could find in all of this research of anyone receiving a text saying, hey, something's happening on this flight. Like, nothing.
Wow.
Which is, again, odd, right? Like, that's odd, because phones were definitely a thing back then. So, at this point, a full-on military search began less than 24 hours later. Satellite imaging was used, and this is the Malaysian military, and they started going out into the Gulf of Thailand, and they actually found oil spill. They found an oil spill in the Gulf of Thailand, and they're like, okay, perfect. It veered off, like, slightly to the right. Like, we're going to look over there. So the search party went out and found the oil and some debris. They analyzed the oil and realized it wasn't jet fuel. It was just fuel from a passing ship that had a leak. Oh. And the debris was just, like, a glitch in their radar. So on March 10th, they moved into the South China Sea because that was where they veered off to the right, they saw. And they saw, like, a few pieces of debris that they thought were debris but weren't, like, there were some false leads that happened, but they didn't really find anything. So finally on March 10th, 2 days after the disappearance, the search on land started happening and they started looking into the passengers. So this revealed a few things. The public learned of those two fake passport people used from Australia and Italy and the Iranians were actually using these two passports. So they did a very extensive search, looked into their social media profiles, their works, their friends, family, called their parents, all of that stuff. Like, it deep dived into these people's personal lives. And what they found was that these two men had absolutely nothing to do with this. And even though what they did was illegal, it was not malicious. They were actually seeking asylum and on their way to Germany. Oh. So they were trying to escape a bad situation. Okay. They confirmed this, and they used Malaysia as their escape route. So they confirmed this when one of the mothers who was expecting her son, and when he didn't show up, the mother actually contacted the authorities and said, hey, this is my son's like trying to get out, and I'm trying to help him. He stole passports. Yes. Where is he? And they determined that these two men were extremely unlikely to be involved in this, in any terrorist activity. Like, they had nothing to do with this. Uh-huh. They did an illegal thing to try and escape.
Okay.
So, then 4 days later, a breakthrough happens. There were a few false leads, like the oil spill, and then those people were investigated. But then on March 11th, Malaysian officials from the media were informed that the Malaysian military actually saw a different path from the plane.
Huh.
Yeah. So, after the transponder went down. Yep, different path than the South China Sea path. So what we know from the transponder, ATC, satellite radius, and the Boeing path is that the plane went north to where it was supposed to go, and then it veered 30 degrees to the right into the right into the South China Sea. The plane didn't go right very far. Like, it just turned right, and then, like, all hell broke loose, and there was nothing. And that's all we knew. So after the transponder went down, the military came forward and said, hey, we got the plane on our radar. What they saw was that the plane going right into the South China Sea about 1:21 a.m., the same time as the transponder. But then, when the transponder went down, the military said no. After they turned right, they see the plane making an immediate left turn about 180 degrees, now pointing back towards Malaysia. And the military said at this point they lost detection of the plane after 8 minutes later at 1:30 a.m.
Like a U-turn.
And the yes, pretty much like a U-turn.
So
back over to Malaysia.
Maybe they were trying to correct themselves, but they went way too far.
Way too far, yeah. So after 8 minutes after that at 1:30 a.m., the military said that they lost transmission of the plane as well. So, because of this, the entire search up until this point was a complete fucking waste of time. It was in the wrong location, the wrong sea entirely.
Yeah.
And we still have no idea why the Malaysian government delayed this information.
Yeah.
Like, there are some guesses, but we don't really know why. So, now that officials have the correct search area defined, they move their efforts into the Strait of Malacca between Malaysia and Indonesia. So after an entire day of searching in this location, the families were becoming fucking pissed. There was an American woman who had her own press conference, because of course she did, saying, we're not going to be quiet. I'm like, calm down. Like, I know you're mad, but, like, it's so American of you to have your own press conference.
For real. God.
Yeah. So, yeah, people were absolutely pissed off about how the military took so long to come forward with this new information. The military, though, yet again, failed massively. So, publicly, they said they stopped tracking the plane at 1:30 a.m. However, a day after they searched into the Strait of Malacca and showed no results, the Malaysian military then came forward again and revealed they actually stopped tracking the plane as late as 3 a.m. During this time, the plane turned again, going west, away from the strait, and towards the Indian Ocean.
What?
So it went forward, right a little bit, turned U-turn, mm-hmm. and then turned again.
Okay.
So, two false search efforts into the wrong sea.
Yeah.
So, when it comes to the hesitation to come forward, it's actually, like, kind of sad. The hesitation for revealing the information, from the timing to them actually tracking the plane, all was because the Malaysian military feared showing the world their technology. Their radar is actually quite advanced, and they didn't want allies in neighboring countries to see them as a new threat. So, understandable. I get it. Like, I understand it. So, the Indian Ocean is now our search area. It is absolutely fucking huge, and Malaysia couldn't do it alone. So, they reached out to neighboring countries, Australia. They asked for some help, and Australia was like, yeah, let's get down to business. So, the Indian Sea is not a friendly place. It's a technical fucking nightmare. The sea is incredibly deep. The radar works best on, like, flat surfaces, not in water. So using radar to look into the water is, again, a nightmare. And the Indian Ocean is really treacherous and was about as far as from an ideal search area as you could probably fucking get. So they searched 180,000 square mile search area. Australian Transport Minister McCormick said of the search, the actual plane is about 60 meters long, so about 200 feet. So we said like 224, I think. He said that's about four times less than the size of the Titanic, which we took more than 70 years to find. Oh. And we had their exact coordinates from where they went down.
Oh my God.
So that kind of puts it into perspective.
Dang.
Of how impossible this search actually is. So, like, if you take anything away from this case, it's that this planet, the ocean, is far bigger than you could ever fucking imagine. So we see a map of a globe. We see a map or a globe, and that, like, I think definitely gives us a skewed idea of the true size of the world. Mm-hmm. And we're not just looking at, like, surface area. We're also looking at the depth of the seas as well.
Right.
And, like, to put this into perspective, according to National Ocean Services, more than 80% of the ocean has never been mapped, explored, or even seen by humans. A far greater percentage of the surfaces of the moon and the planet Mars have been mapped and studied than our own ocean floor. Hmm. So additionally, this is by far the first flight to go missing. There are actually top 10 lists of the most mysterious plane crashes. We all know of Amelia Earhart, but there are other ones as well. Air France Flight 447 went missing about a decade ago, a lot like this one. The difference here is that they were able to locate the plane as the transponders were still functioning. It just took a long time to locate because, again, it disappeared into nothing. In 2016, an Indian Air Force plane disappeared. The Antonov AN-32 twin-engine turboprop transport aircraft from the Indian Air Force disappeared with 29 people on board while flying over the Bay of Bengal. In July 2016, the plane was going from one Air Force station to the port of Blair. The search and rescue operation became India's largest search operation at that point for a missing plane. It involved submarines, surface vessels, aircraft. The mission was called off in September with no trace of the plane. So they never found that plane. Like, it's this ocean. You could fit the United States and, like, part of Russia just in the Indian Ocean.
Okay, that's pretty big.
Like, this is massive. This is fucking massive. Like, I just need to say that because people are probably like, how do you lose a plane? Well, it's easy. Yeah. If you lose radar and then you're in the middle of nowhere, like, plus so little. We know so little.
Right. Plus, we know from our Bermuda Triangle episode. Well, first of all, this is nowhere near the Bermuda Triangle. However, from our Bermuda Triangle episode, we learned that there are currents in the ocean and they can move shipwrecks or plane wrecks wherever.
Very strong. Yeah, very strong. So on March 20th, 12 days after this disappearance, Malaysian officials asked the world for help. Altogether, 26 countries ended up coming together, including the United States, for like an all-out search effort. The prime minister said, this is above politics. We need your help. And the world came together and tried to find this plane. So throughout this time, people were also coming out, including a fisherman and an oil rig worker, stating that they saw a plane flying unusually low. Some reported seeing a burning object flying through the sky in the Indian Ocean, in the Maldives, which is like below India. On April 4th, a new search team went out targeting the black boxes that we talked about, which are audio recording devices from the cockpit. They emit a short range like ping after they're submerged underwater, so they're trying to see if those were still active, and they couldn't find anything like that either. They did have a lot of false leads. They found possible like orange life-saving devices like inflatable boats, but all leads ended up being dead ends. And then on May 2nd, the Malaysian government decided to start their deep sea exploration, where they were using deep sea devices to go ahead and look on the ocean floor. So the size of the area they were exploring was about the size of the continental United States, which is huge. Yeah. It lasted months. They found nothing relating to MG or MH370. And in May 2015, a year and some months later, after costing the Malaysian government $155 million, they called off the search.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So the search was the most expensive and expansive search for an aircraft in history, like in world history.
And unsuccessful, too. So that's quite the bummer.
They found nothing. And you, with 26 countries involved and the technology that they have, you know that they did what they could.
They didn't have like, it.
No, this was a whole-ass effort, and that whole-ass costed over $155 million. So 2 months after the decision to stop the search, on July 29th, 2015, beach cleaners on a 20-square-mile island of St. Andre, Reunion, just east of Madagascar off the coast of Africa, found something washed ashore. What they found was a 7-foot-long sheet of metal with serial number 28420. The authorities were contacted, and that's a French-owned island, and the French government flew in to investigate. So 28420 was the same serial number as the parts of MH370, and it was a missing piece of the plane. It was the right flaperon that assists with momentum control. That week, they also found a damaged suitcase, a Chinese water bottle, an Indonesian like cleaning product, like, you know, like Lysol or whatever. So this was finally giving the family some hope in the world, hope that we are closer to actually finding this plane. So thing is this was over 4,000 miles away from where the plane likely went down or disappeared. Upon further digging and investigating, two more pieces of debris washed ashore. A wing flap came ashore in 2016 and a wing fragment in May of 2017. So both were on small islands up the coast of Africa. All were French territories. So these are all officially confirmed to be parts of MH370. And this means that these pieces traveled basically the entire length of the Indian Ocean in the span of a year and a half. So they traveled pretty much the distance of Russia.
Yeah, wow.
Over a year and a half to get to these places. So those are the facts. Those are like on paper, tangible facts that we have. And this has spurred a lot of conspiracy theories. This is like a conspiracy theorist's dream, basically. So here are our theories. And then I want to know what you think happened. So, theory one, the pieces of the plane were planted, of course. There is actually, you know, it's not a bad theory. Here's why. So the basis of this comes from the fact that the pieces of the plane that were found were from the right side of the plane. Specifically, the pieces of the plane were from their white wing, which, if you can remember, this plane back in 2012 was in a crash on the tarmac in China, and the right wing, in its entirety, not just its tip, needed to be replaced. So there are pieces of this wing, this right wing, that could be in graveyards, airplane graveyards at someplace. Okay. So these wings are taken to they're called airplane boneyards, basically junkyard for planes. The closest ones to the site of the debris are in Australia. The second closest is in Spain. So the theory is once the plane was disassembled in 2012, a government organization, secret or otherwise, stole the pieces and flew the pieces out into the Indian Ocean and let the current take the pieces away so it looked like a natural finding. The evidence to support this is barnacles. So, the barnacles cover the top and the bottom and the sides. This is only possible if the entire 200-pound, 7-foot piece of metal was fully submerged. But when tested, this piece of the plane, the large 7-foot piece, it floated. So why would there be barnacles surrounding the entire thing? Scientists confirm that if this truly had barnacles all over it, this piece would have had to been fully submerged for a very long time.
Yeah.
in order for it to be completely covered. Mm. Furthermore, the barnacles that covered the debris were from waters much cooler than where the debris was found. The barnacles were more consistent with water from around Australia, where one of the boneyards are. So the theorists think that these pieces were tethered underwater around Australia and then planted on St. Andrew Reunion and the other islands after this disappearance and an adequate amount of time had passed.
Mm-hmm. But why?
So the motivation for this, is theorists think that the Malaysian government did this just because of pressure. So Malaysian officials were under severe pressure from not only being able to find a single fucking lead of this disappearance, theorists think that they planted or paid someone to plant evidence to take the heat off of them. Because over a year later, there were still protests happening about this disappearance.
Okay.
So finally, the Malaysian government confirmed that these pieces were 100% without a shadow of a doubt pieces of MH370 before the French government even had a chance to test them. So the Malaysian government were like, yep, you found them. We're good. We're good to go. And the French were like, no, we have to test these first. This is our territory. We need to test them. The French government did find discrepancies stating it is likely, but they cannot 100% confirm that these are pieces of MH370. The discrepancy caused families of lost ones to riot, send death threats to officials to say that it was pieces of the plane without confirming. And they felt like the Malaysian government was just trying to get them basically to shut up and take the hush money instead of, like, letting them continue to search. Because the families were given compensation money for this. Mm-hmm. So on August 16, 2017, six pieces were found on a beach of Madagascar. And many of the pieces didn't have barnacle growth that would be expected. So we either have too much barnacle growth or we have not enough. Also, a Malaysian government official who was familiar with this type of mission, he was a seasoned diplomat. His expertise was actually in Madagascar diplomacy, and he was familiar with wreckage and how to, like, go about this thing. He rearranged his schedule and was sent out to Madagascar right away to personally secure the items for testing. However, he never showed up. He was assassinated before he even arrived at the location, and the assailant was never caught. So there is a government assassination happening.
Okay.
Well. I know, right? Yeah. So that is the theory that this whole thing was, these things were planted. The second thing here is reasons for the radar to go down. So three flights around the world a day experience in-flight smoke issues and fires. You have a 1 in 10,000 chance of your plane being on fire at some point. So that's scary. Because of this, theorists believe that air traffic controller, the transponder, and the ACAR system all went down because of an in-flight fire, which caused pilots to blindly turn the plane around in an attempt to head back to Malaysia. Oh. This doesn't explain, however, why they turned around towards the Indian Ocean and why the pilots were so calm over the radio when there may have been a fire. Because remember, they said good night, good morning, that happened. And why the plane had seemingly been fine for 7 additional hours once communication had been lost. Because they were flying at an appropriate height and at an appropriate speed for a plane that is A-OK. So, The next reason of why the radar may have gone down is the circuit breaker was removed. So one of the pilots would have literally had needed to physically take out the circuit breaker by hand, and that is very against policy. Like, you don't do that. You only do that in case of extreme emergency. So looking into the pilots and their backstories, that was brought back into play. Hamid, the younger one, had no real marks against him besides being cocky and liking the showgirls his cockpit. Shah, however, was a little sus. His depressive episodes were seemingly out of nowhere. He was spending hours in his in-flight simulator, and his family left him a day before the flight. Was like, you know, a lot of like depression fuel. So they looked at his simulator. It was built to replicate a Boeing 777, and many of the flights he took were very similar to the path MH370 took. But this was also very common for him because the flight was like us taking a flight to Mexico, like a, you know, someone take a flight to Mexico. Like, it was a common path that one would take. So when looking at the simulator, some data was actually deleted. We don't know how much, but we do know that it was an intentional deletion of data. The FBI also noticed that the deleted data showed a path through the South Indian Ocean. However, if this info hadn't been deleted, it would have just seemed like a regular flight path he would have taken. So it's odd, yes, but it's not incriminating. So the belief with the radar going down and blaming Shah was that he took out the circuit breaker, incapacitated Hamid, his flight captain, his co-captain, purposefully veered the plane off course over the Indian Ocean in a mass suicide homicide.
Yeah.
Because of his depression. So this theory is one of the least accepted ones by professionals because Shah had no previous patterns of red flags indicating he wanted to harm anyone. His family and friends stated that he would have been like the hero in this scenario, if anything. And the things in his life with a divorce and the simulator were like human things for someone to go through. Like it was nothing drastic. Experts believed a Boeing 777 could lose all sources of tracking in a cyber hijacking. So this is the next theory. So we have the pieces were planted. That was like the big conspiracy theory. And then we have like the weird things that happened and why those weird things would have happened. So, we have the radar, weird thing one, weird thing two. This is the third weird thing with the radar. So experts believed a Boeing 777 could lose all sources of tracking in a cyber hijacking. Believe it or not, a cyber hijacking has actually never, ever happened.
Oh.
Ever.
Huh.
We think it has. Cyber hijacking isn't a thing that happens. It happens in movies. It's not a real life thing. So the basis of this is that Honeywell, you know, electronic company Honeywell and Boeing got together after 9/11 and created the Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot system, which is a real thing. It basically allows a plane to land itself like a Tesla vehicle. The system, though, isn't actually officially in any airlines at this point. It's just in testing. However, some believe it actually is, we just don't know. And when Boeing is making their aircrafts, they're installing it and just not listing it officially as part of a plane. So, people believe a third-party government hijacked this piece of tech, took over the plane, and these systems work through a satellite, and the satellite was working, we know. The incentive to do all this was all about the cargo. In May 2014, the Malaysian government released the cargo manifest. It listed everything in there, but some of the weights didn't add up. It kept on totaling to the wrong number, and they kept on re-releasing the manifest. So on there, the manifest said that there was a really large supply of lithium ion batteries for like cell phones and computers. They said it equated to 5,400 pounds of batteries on board. A month later, Malaysia Airlines said, no, the manifest was wrong. The batteries accounted for 221 pounds of the 5,400 pounds of cargo. The other part of it was, quote, radio accessories and chargers. However, we were never told what radio accessories and chargers were. So many believe that the real cargo was contraband or weapons. And who exactly wanted this cargo and ordered the attack to make this plane go down to get that cargo? Many believe it was the U.S. government and that the U.S. government planned for this very thing to happen even before the flight took off, like months before, like pre-planned it. So the reason for this is actually quite interesting. The Diego Garcia military base is a U.S. military base. It's located in the Indian Ocean. It is 6,720 acres. It's 12 square miles. It's heavily vegetated. It's fucking beautiful. And it's an extremely tiny island. It has been active and under U.S. control since 1971, and not a single civilian or reporter has ever stepped foot on the U.S. military base. So, there are many accounts of mysterious planes landing on this base over time. There are YouTube stories, blog posts, Reddit posts of people allegedly coming forward and saying that this base holds many secrets. The island has tons of conspiracy theories about it. So theorists say that the U.S. knew about the cargo and other mysterious things on the Malaysian government and things the Malaysian government was trying to sneak on board MH370. So the U.S. came up with a plan to keep the plane from reaching China by taking over the autopilot and landing it on the U.S. military base, Diego Garcia. From there, the cargo and passengers were captured, kept on that island, reminding you of Lost a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. So the weird turn that the plane took was meant to be a distraction, and the parts found on the islands were fabricated and planted by the U.S. government. Hmm. Boeing is, after all, a U.S. company that works with the government.
It's true.
Just saying. So there are also eyewitnesses that claim to have seen the plane flying over that we saw, like, a burning... We said, like, that oil rigger saw the burning plane, whatever. They claim that the plane was so low it could see the outline of the doors of the plane. However, this claim points to a slight change in theory. Instead of the plane landing on Diego Garcia and the U.S. taking control of it in a cyber hijacking, these sightings were actually from an island called Cutahuvadu, which is 700 miles south of Diego Garcia. If the plane were that low at that point, that far away, it's about a 15-minute plane flight from the island to the military base, it's likely the U.S. military instead would have just shot the plane down as it was in U.S. airspace without permission. So, being that low, so far away from an airstrip would not have allowed for MH370 to land safely. The procedure of the U.S. military would have been as follows, per Chris Yates, who is an independent aviation analyst. He said, the U.S. would have ID'd the aircraft coming at their country, because at that point, a military base is the U.S. That's our country. They would have saw it, and with no identification, the fighter jets would have been deployed to inspect and then shot the threat down. So, this still ends with the U.S. hiding the plane and planting debris. Either way, the support of this theory comes from a guy named Peter McCann, who is an amateur crash investigator who uses Google Maps. He combed Google Maps for days and days at a time looking for MH370 and found an area in the Indian Ocean after 4 years in 2018. It's 10 miles south of an island called Round Island. He found a very visible, like, you can Google this, it's a plane. It is literally a plane, a full-on plane, in frame, with both wings and the tail attached, along with visible big bullet holes in it. The plane is no longer on Google Maps, though. However, he did screenshot it, and you can Google it. Officials also did confirm that this could be the plane after he showed it to them, and this would definitely discredit the debris that was previously found. Uh-huh. They have yet to go and explore this area.
Wow.
So... all in all, 239 passengers were on board, 227 were regular passengers, 12 were crew members. However, 228 tickets were scanned into the plane, so there was one extra accounted for, or that was unaccounted for. So that got some people thinking, like, it was a hijacking, it was a terrorist, but likely what it was when you're boarding a plane, the tickets sold are on a piece of paper, and that gets, like, stored in the system, so they're expecting 228 people. It's far more likely that someone was sitting in that waiting area after they scanned their ticket in and just had to leave last minute and couldn't get on the plane that they planned on getting
on.
That's likely
and
what
that
happened.
That person is very people lucky.
is very lucky. That person has not come forward, but that is another kind of piece of the puzzle where people are like, was it a terrorist attack? And it's like, probably not. No terrorist organization has ever come out and admitted that they did this, which doesn't happen. If a terrorist group comes out and does something like this, it's they want the attention for it.
Yeah. That's the point of it.
So, yes. So, we have planted debris because Malaysia just wanted them to shut up. And then we have... so that's the one conspiracy theory. And then we have the other oddities of the radar went down. Why did it go down? Either it was the U.S. military, a terrorist attack, or mass suicide, homicide situation happening. Those are, like, our theories. The most likely thing that happened, according to officials, was This was not an act of mass suicide or a cockpit fire causing mechanical failure. Most likely, MH370 was redirected manually, meaning inside the cockpit, by a hijacker or one of the pilots, and it crashed. The remains are still largely undiscovered and underwater, and with the ocean current, the same part of the ocean is never the same twice.
Yeah.
So, that is that mystery. And then 2 days ago, a dude came forward, a British engineer, and he said that we know the last full-scale search of MH370 happened in 2018 by U.S. robotics company Ocean Infinity. They covered nearly 50,000 square feet and not a single thing was recovered. However, Richard Godfrey said that there is a new tracking system called Weak Signal Propagation Reporter, WSPR. He said it's like having a bunch of tripwires that work in every single direction over on the horizon and onto the other side of the globe. And it's now being used to accurately calculate the final destination of MH370 before it disappeared. So it's just like a grid of radio signals that allows planes to be tracked as if they're going through those tripwires. And this is leading experts to believe that they could actually find this plane because it's giving a lot of like promising results. So Godfrey said together the two systems could be used to detect satellite and the system could be used to detect, identify, and localize MH370 during its flight path into the Indian Ocean. He's very confident that the plane crashed at 8:19 a.m. He said they have a lot of data from satellite. We have oceanography, drift analysis, and the performance data from Boeing, and now this technology. All four of those things align with one particular point in the Indian Ocean. So, the Broken Ridge location, which is where they expected to be, was not in the original 2015 search area. It was just missed by about 18 miles by Ocean Infinity in 2018. However, that area was searched in 2016 and no one found anything. So last month, this dude, Godfrey, said that he discussed the flight simulator data, saying the analysis by these two dudes, from Microsoft Flight Simulator, these two Microsoft dudes looked into Shah's extensive home flight computer setup, and this Godfrey dude thinks that that is like a smoking gun, basically. However, authorities are still saying they found nothing out of the ordinary, as we mentioned, on the flight simulator. Yes, he deleted data, but none of the paths he took were out of the realm of possibility of an actual flight that he would have taken. Like, there was nothing, like, especially odd about anything. But Godfrey claims that there was, and he said that the Shah's simulated flight from Kuala Lumpur via the Malacca Strait, which he did do that. Godfrey claims that he took the plane in a simulator to the point of exhaustion to see how far he could take the plane before it was crashed and then did that in real life.
Oh.
So that's what he's claiming. And we don't know if this is true or not, meaning we're unsure if the fuel exhaustion that was shown, because fuel exhaustion was shown on the flight simulator, we're not sure if it was intentional or not, because Shah did speed up the in-flight, he fast-forwarded the flight.
Yeah.
So we don't know. We don't know his intention behind that. We don't know if he intentionally drove that flight to to fuel exhaustion or not.
That's a very good thing to go off of, because anyone who's played The Sims, you like put them in a pool and then you like take out the ladder just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to do that to a person in real life, but it's The Sims.
But yeah.
Like, who cares?
I know. So yeah, I don't like this Godfrey dude. I don't like him blaming our dude Shah, but you know, it is what it is. He thinks that the fact that he took this flight and drove the plane to flight exhaustion is like a smoking gun.
I say no.
So I say no either. So that's his thing. He's like, we know where this plane is. I'm going to use this new tool and find it. So good on you. Hope you find it. So since 2014, 33 pieces of debris have been found in six countries using the serial number, including South Africa and Madagascar. Experts believe this proves the plane plunged into the Indian Ocean and the debris is taken westward.
Okay.
So that is the story of MH370 and the disappearing plane.
That is very mysterious.
What do you think happened?
I wouldn't... I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. government had something to do with it, like, conspiracy-wise. Like, I would not be surprised.
Yeah. Some of the things I was looking at is, like, the number one conspiracy, the number one, like, main conspiracy theory is that the things were planted. Mm-hmm. The weird things drive to, like, mini conspiracy theories. Like, yes, we know that it's not a secret, it's not a conspiracy that the radar went off. It's why did the radar go off? I don't think that I think it's really cool that we have a military base in the middle of an Indian Ocean that is basically the United States and no civilian has ever been on it. And, like, honestly, if a plane is coming at us and we don't know about it, yeah, shoot it down. You don't know what that plane is doing. But after they shoot it down, they'd be like, oh, shit, this was a commercial airline. Now we have to cover this
up. Yeah, because they couldn't
bury the plane.
I mean, I'm sure that they tried to make, like, radio contact with whatever is flying at them. But if they didn't have that available, then maybe they thought they were ignoring them.
Right, for some type of reason. And I think it's perfectly plausible that, you know what? What if the plane was hijacked and the hijacker knew that U.S. military base was there?
Yeah.
You know? And then the U.S. military now has to hide this plane.
Right.
And I mean, like, plant evidence that it, you know.
Like, no terrorist organization said that they didn't, like, claim it, but there's tons of rogue, you know, crazy terrorists that would want to do, you know, stuff on their own. I don't know.
Random shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is a good theory. Some people don't think that that's a valid, like, a good theory, but, like,
I kind of do.
The U.S. military is, it's strong. like, don't fuck with them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, truly, like, you wouldn't want to do that. So I think that that is a solid theory. I think the other theory that they just fucking got lost and didn't know where to go and just happened to miss Malaysia and now we're like, fuck, where are we going? Is also, you know, possible. Why did the radar and stuff go off? We don't know.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I hope they find it someday.
I know, I do too. When we're done with this, I'm going to send you the Google Maps image of the plane and you're going to be like, holy shit.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's insane. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for, I know that is a really long episode, but I'm not sorry about it because welcome to Perfect Stranglers. now I have to Google this MH370 image. I just have to. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for joining us. And you know what? I would love to hear what you think about this. I want to hear your theories. Go ahead and email us, contact@perfectstranglers.com, or send us, you know, some DMs. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah. We sure would. And also happy holidays once again.
Happy holidays, and we will chat with you next Thursday.
Bye, everyone.